Be ready for life's ups and downs with Bupa. Get up to 10 weeks free when you join on eligible products. Plus, we'll waive the 2 and 6 month waiting period on extras. T's and C's apply. Search Bupa 10 weeks free today. Bupa, because life happens.
G'day, I'm Jason Owen and I've lost 29 kilos with the help of Jenny Craig. And I feel like a new person. I couldn't have done it on my own. Jenny Craig knows weight loss. You get real results with real food. Plus, support from your very own weight loss coach to help you along the way. What are you waiting for? Visit jennycraig.com.au or call 13 19 92 to get started.
This is the Ocean Protect podcast, talking about the issues that face our oceans and what we can do about it. Presented by Ocean Protect, committed to change.
Jeremy, how are you?
I am dandy. How are you, Brad? I mean, I can see you've done your hair today.
I'm living the dream and keeping it real, Jeremy. I'm fighting fit and feeling fabulous.
Enough about you.
Well, thanks for asking and not waiting for the answer. But look, enough about us because we are joined by a wonderful guest today. And Justine Barrett is, well, she's a superstar, would be the main job title. Thanks. But she's a research technician from CSIRO's Marine Debris Group. And I think actually one of the best things about this podcast is that we get to learn a little bit more about the people behind the title. And obviously, Justine, we've collaborated a little bit. I think we met for the first time in Tasmania, where you wowed the masses with a amazing talk at the, I think it was the Urban Water Symposium.
Yes. Well, I call every stormwater event a stormtrooper event, though.
Stormtrooper.
Stormtrooper event. Yeah.
I do like that title.
We should all change our titles.
If I had a business card, I'd change it immediately. I'm actually keen to delve into some of the science that I know we both love, but we always love to get a backstory. How does this journey all begin, Justine? So first up, where are you calling from?
I am in Tasmania, southern Tasmania, about half an hour south of Hobart is where I reside, in a little town called Kettering, which is where you catch the ferry to Bruny Island. That's our claim to fame. But I grew up and spent most of my life actually in country Victoria, in a little town of only a couple of thousand people. It's called Mervery North.
There you go.
Tiny little place. Yeah. I'm seventh generation in my family to be born in that town.
Really?
So I broke the mold and I moved to a different state. But the rest of my family, the rest of my immediate family is still there.
I actually originally born and raised in Bendigo in country Victoria. I must admit, I haven't heard of your little town. Nothing against your hometown, but why did you move?
We moved because my husband was starting a degree, actually. He started an engineering degree at UTAS as a mature age student with three children. So that's been a bit of a journey. Yeah, I do not recommend it. That was 6 years ago and it's still going.
And how did you get involved with plastic pollution and CSIRO? So you obviously went along with your husband?
Yes. Yeah, I did. So I've been in the science industry since I was 16, actually.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, right back. The very first science job I had was in a milk factory.
Milk factory?
Yeah, quality testing on milk.
I can make you test pretty quick and easy. It's all terrible.
Well, most of us just do the sniff test, don't we?
Exactly. We don't. Yeah. What are you testing the milk for? Quality, for contamination?
Pus levels.
Bacteria levels. Bacteria levels and percentage of fats and things like that.
Yeah. Right.
It's all good. Don't worry. Anything bad would get taken out straight away.
No, I love milk. My mate here doesn't. No. So, you know.
Please continue on your journey.
One of the next towns across from where I grew up, there was a small regional campus of Monash University. I didn't want to do any of the degrees, but I wanted to stay in the area. So the one I least loathed was science, and that's how I got into science. So it's not some magical, you know, I grew up following documentaries and being curious. It's not like that at all for me, unfortunately. I just kind of fell into it, and it's grown on me over the years. So I've worked in the water quality industry as well. I worked in a coal-fired power station for a couple of years. I've worked at a university as a technician, a chemistry technician, and I've taught chemistry at uni as well. And then I decided to do a master's, and I did that in Antarctic and marine science, and that's kind of how I fell into doing work with Denise at CSIRO, doing plastics.
Because that trip to Antarctica, was that through the Homeward Bound scholarship or award that you were given?
Yeah. So I was very, very fortunate, and I was a part of the second cohort of Homeward Bound ladies. So it's women from all around the world in the STEM field doing a 12-month leadership course that culminates in a 3-week trip to Antarctica, which was incredible and intense and just mind-blowing in many, many ways.
There's not a lot of people that get that opportunity. What's it like? I mean, we've had a few guests on that have been down there, but their experiences were all different. What are your one-liners? What was it like?
It's surreal. Like, we left from Argentina, the very bottom of Argentina. And so it's a 2-day crossing. Yeah, Ushuaia. We did a couple of days of intense training in a hotel, and our trip leader one day said, you know, our ship's out the window, have a look down in the port, and there's all these massive cruise ships, and then there's this tiny little ship between all the big ships. Yeah, that's ours. And we kind of went, you mean that little tugboat?
Wow.
So our ship was really basic, but it was a 2-day crossing. It was relatively smooth, actually, and then it was very, very foggy and misty, but you can start the very first kind of signs of life was we could hear penguins. So you could hear little squeaks of penguins, and so we knew we were close. And, yeah, then just very, very, very gradually start to see the outline of icebergs. And it's so surreal. Like, it gives me goosebumps thinking about it now, just to be in that situation where you're so remote and it's almost out of this world kind of thing. Yeah, just phenomenal.
And it wasn't just a junket, I'm guessing. It was you were there to do some sort of scientific endeavours or?
So we didn't actually do any science research in Antarctica. It was the leadership.
Oh, okay, right. There you go. Cool.
So we were down at the peninsula, Antarctic Peninsula, and we visited a lot of the research stations down there from different countries. We were able to get off the ship most days, actually, and just sort of sit with Antarctica. But in between all that, we had lots of lectures around the wildlife down there, the impacts of climate change and ways that we could go about changing that and shifting that. And I must admit, after 3 weeks of being down there, I felt like I needed to leave, like we were intruding on the most precious place on the planet and we really should get out of there. I felt like us humans just don't belong. We need to leave it alone.
Wow. That's interesting. Yeah.
Having said that, what a privilege to go down there in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it's you are privileged. I mean, anyone that gets to go down
absolutely.
There, certainly on my bucket list to do one day. I mean, if it's still going to be around by the time I, get my ass down there.
Well, just on that, so you're obviously there talking about climate change, you were saying. What aspects of that?
We talked a lot about, human impacts. That's the part that I found the most challenging, actually. There was one day where we're walking along a pebbled beach that was very obviously very isolated. Everything down there is isolated, and I found rubbish on the beach. I found a popped balloon. So we talk a lot about that. We spoke a lot about the human impacts, what carbon emissions are doing to warming, the plastic pollution issues globally, but also the unfairness of climate change. It's the wealthy countries that are polluting the most, but it's the countries that are poorest that are being the most impacted. So it's really quite depressing being part of these conversations all the time. And then on top of that, seeing it firsthand.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. Seeing it firsthand must be.
Yeah, that's really, it kind of hits you like a truck. So our ship leader, our trip leader, he's been going down to Antarctica for decades, and he would say, see that little island over there that never used to be there, the iceberg used to come in all the way to, another kilometre beyond where it is now. And while we were down there, we saw a lot of krill ships and things like that. And, just seeing those impacts, and I sort of think, part of it is, why do we need to fish for krill? Why do we have to come to the end of the earth to fish for resources? Can't us humans leave it alone? Can't we just dial it back a little bit? We're already having so much impact.
Yeah, it must be quite emotional. I mean, I just before when you were talking, I was visualizing myself walking down a beach, seeing some rubbish. It would fucking destroy me. You'd be like, why? And then, of course, you understand why. And it's just drawing the dots up, which must be very confronting. It's all very well seeing it in
magazines. It's a mess in the head. Yeah, it's a head. I'm not going to say the word, but it's a head.
Yeah.
It's really, you feel so small being a human down there, being a small group of people. You feel really, really tiny because it's such a massive place, huge mountains and, towering icebergs. But there's evidence of us little people having so much impact. So It's, it feels so unbalanced that humans have such an impact on the rest of the planet that, yeah, really smacks you in the face down there.
The irony is that, what, do we have to go to Antarctica now to do beach cleanups?
Yeah, well, yeah. There's certainly a lot of research emerging in litter in Antarctica, and not so much on beaches, but there's been litter found in sediment around the research stations, things like that, because previously they used to bury their rubbish down there or sit it in a pile on an iceberg that they knew would melt over summer.
Wow.
And obviously we have a lot more restrictions now, but, you know, yeah, there's lots of stories around that.
And you've mentioned how that trip led to some sort of collaboration with Denise Hardesty from CSIRO, who we've had on the podcast previously. So how did that come about?
Yeah, we actually had a social homeward bound catch-up in Hobart, and there's not that many of us, and so I met Denise there and told her that I was doing masters and looking for a project, and she said, come and see me next week. So I ended up doing a project with Denise, analysing deep sea sediment from a couple of hundred kilometres off the coast of South Australia, so from the Great Australian Bight, and I analysed that sediment for microplastics. And, of course, we found some. Human impact is everywhere. And then we used those figures along with other deep sea sediment microplastic figures to estimate it, to provide a global estimate of how much microplastics are in the ocean floor.
Is that how that, I think you first came across my radar? I think you wrote a conversation article piece, and I'll include a link to the show notes, and it's called, gives the results away, but it's called, we estimate up to 15 million tons of microplastics lie on the seafloor. It's worse than what we thought. Is that how, that's the article that came out of your research?
Yeah, that's right. It's devastating research. And as a scientist, it's devastating doing that research, because I'm saying, look, everybody, here's a problem, but I'm not actually telling you how to fix it. And I find that really frustrating. That's part of the problem with all this, is it's so big that we don't know how to deal with it. So most of the work that we do in the marine debris team is actually about providing evidence to a problem and then come out with solutions on how to fix it. So, and that's what I much prefer. I'd much prefer to say, this is the problem, this is how we fix it, rather than just going, yeah, this is the issue, someone else deal with it.
Well, if you think about it, and just going back to going, the problem's so big, if you break it down to us humans and our lives, when we've got a lot going on, it's hard to focus. You know, I've got this to do, I've got that. You know, how do you fix those problems? But then you scale it up to the world. No wonder there's headless chickens going around going, hey, what do we do? How do we do it? And sometimes it does feel overwhelming. Environmental depression, it's like, well, as you said, how do we fix it? But without the research and getting that data out to the world, it's such a vital part.
It helps create the picture.
It does. And we need to create that picture.
We all need pictures and stories, absolutely.
Yeah. And to solve a problem, you need to understand it. And to understand it, you need data. And just on that, so 14 million tonnes of microplastic lie on the seafloor. That's obviously an enormous figure that just sort of washes over most people. And I think a lot of people don't actually realise, I think, am I right in saying the vast majority of plastic in our ocean is actually at the seafloor? So I remember a Eunomia research figure estimated some 94% of all ocean plastic is on the seafloor. Is that sound about right?
I haven't seen that figure. The figure that I've seen is around 70%. They're all estimations, but yeah, the majority is on the seafloor.
That's really interesting. And because there's a lot of interest in the ocean cleanup, for example, and focusing on cleaning plastic from the surface of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. And it's estimated, correct me if I'm wrong, about 1% of all plastic in our oceans is at the sea level, at the sea surface. So obviously a cleanup activity like ocean cleanup can only focus on that top very small proportion in that Pacific garbage patch. It sort of indicates to me that we're probably focusing on the wrong way to solve this problem. Obviously, you know, it's far more effective to obviously stop it from going into the oceans in the first place than it is to clean it up.
I'm really glad you mentioned that.
Don't talk to us about it. That's a lead-in sort of thing that he's saying.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It just seems right. Pretty pictures. People need pictures. You know, we're making such a big impact. We're pulling all this stuff in. Great. Pat ourselves on the back. It's far easier to do that than to do the dirty work.
It does raise awareness.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's visually very difficult to tell a story about plastic on the seafloor because, let's face it, who's down there? But obviously we need researchers like CSIRO and others to sort of, you know, excuse the pun, bring this issue to the surface.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just out of interest also, like when plastic goes to the seafloor, I'm not even sure if you can answer this, but does it stay there or does it – I've heard this sort of terminology of oceans burping microplastics into the atmosphere. Is that a thing?
Oh, I haven't heard that.
There you go.
I'm curious. I'll follow it up after this. There's certainly a lot of evidence that suggests that plastic moves around the ocean floor and around the ocean in general through tidal movements. And on the surface, the solar radiation also degrades it and makes it, turns into smaller pieces. And with that, and the wave action breaks it down further. So, you know, one larger piece might become thousands of smaller pieces. What it does on the seafloor, we don't have a whole lot of research around that, around its movements and the breakdowns, because like you say, we're not down there, we can't see it. And it's really expensive to do that kind of research. And so I guess we know now that there is a big problem down there, but still very expensive to get down there. And what we do in this, the marine debris group at CSIRO, is focus less on that side of the problem and more on how can we prevent it. And, you know, the big cleanup of the Great Garbage Patch, things like that are wonderful and really raise a lot of awareness. And they're all doing, you know, really good things, but we feel it's best to try and stop the rubbish, and same as what you guys do, try and stop the litter getting into the ocean to begin with. And once we've figure that out, then we'll go to the ocean and start looking at how to remove what we've already put in there.
I think you're going back to Timmy Silverwood season 2, where he was talking about the research of underground plastic tsunamis.
Yeah, but also you might remember we had a chat with Janice Brani, I think from the University of Utah, which talked about, you know, microplastics being transferred in the atmosphere over thousands of kilometres and landing in massive quantities in even the most remote areas like American national parks like Yellowstone and the Grand Canyon, like areas where people basically aren't, but still having really, really high fallouts from the atmosphere of microplastics, which sort of lends to the question is, where is it coming from? And it's obviously coming from somewhere else, but where? And there was a theory that she had was that maybe this, some of this microplastics is actually being released from the oceans and into the atmosphere and then being transferred via wind action thousands of kilometers. It's scary to think about, but it's also probably more of a concern how little we actually know about the implications, whether it's from a human health perspective or ecological implications associated with all that plastic on the sea floor. 14 million tons. It's just, it's out of this world, but clearly it is still our world.
It's too much to comprehend, isn't it? Kudos to the ocean. If the ocean's burping it out and sending it back to land, like, you know, that's great. But yeah, it's pretty, to paint that picture in your head, it's pretty devastating.
We roughly know that the vast majority of the pollution that's in our ocean is coming from land-based sources. We know that. And we know that urban areas contribute a hell of a lot, and some of the major rivers up in Asia can, you know, they contribute a hell of a lot more. One thing that we go around on the show as well, let's just call it 80% of the pollution comes from those land-based sources. So why is not 80% of our attention, 80% of our resources going on stopping that? And we, Brad and I, get very frustrated because, you know, ocean cleanup, as you say, from an awareness point of view, fantastic. It's great. But it's a hell of a lot of money getting in there trying to sort of skim the top of the problem without going into it. But people feel great about it. It makes them feel good. Pete Kalinske with his Seabin, which is a rubbish bin that sits within marinas. Fantastic technology to raise awareness. And I know Pete's pivoted a bit and realized that he does know that, you know, he's only scratching on the surface. But gee, I tell you what, Discovery Channel, Coca-Cola, everyone's jumped on that and gone, great, we've got a Seabin. You know, what's that actually achieving? And it bugs us a little bit that the focus isn't on the science. The focus is on feel good. I mean, how do you, in your day job, how do you handle that, knowing what you know?
Yeah, it's frustrating, absolutely. I can appreciate your frustration. I think the reason why we, as people, really grab onto those feel-good stories is because the problem is so big that it feels out of our control. So those little feel-good stories make us feel a little more like we're in control. Yeah, there is so much to do. And after coming off, so a couple of weeks ago was the International Marine Debris Conference, so much of the focus was around monitoring, and so establishing baselines around countries for, and that's a lot of the work that we do, establishing baselines, getting data for the amount of litter around coastal areas that each country is producing. That's a starting point. But I was really surprised out of the conference how little technologies that there was being developed in this area. I was disappointed, actually.
I spent 20 years of environmental consulting, and you know, one of the things that you often see written in environmental management plans or environmental impact assessments is this monitoring, you know, proposal. And look, monitoring's, I wouldn't say it's a waste of time, but it doesn't do anything to solve the problem. And a lot of sort of particularly big infrastructure projects, mining, et cetera, they'll say they do monitoring. It's basically just watching the world burn. It's just not good enough. We need to act. the technologies to actually stop this pollution, there's no probably new ones because they've already been around. Like we've been putting in storm retrieving assets, you know, gully pit inserts, gross pollutant traps, spire retention systems for 20 years. These devices, these assets are highly effective at stopping pollution, but we know we're only the sort of one step up the waste management hierarchy in front of cleanup. We need to essentially just ban single-use plastics. We need to significantly reduce the production of plastic items and obviously their careless management. Simple as that. The solutions are ready to rock and roll.
That's the thing. There is solutions out there. It's a cost thing.
We have Ocean Protect. We've certainly done the numbers, and it's far cheaper to stop it at source than it is to go out and clean it up. And you know, Brad can give you all the examples in the world. And yet, no one really listens to us. Well, you know, what do they know? Well, let's be honest.
Yeah, you look like it.
Yeah, we're doing a really big push in the stormwater space at the moment with our research, our plastics research. I think part of the issue is one is trying to put stormwater, put the fact that all that marine pollution is coming from our backyards into the public eye, and, you know, trying to make stormwater a little more sexy because it's just out of sight, out of mind.
Well, if there's ever been two roosters ready to make stormwater sexy, it's Jeremy Brown Esquire and Brad the Big Deal Dalrymple. So, and here we are.
Just saying.
Should we start with the calendar?
Don't. He will. He certainly will.
I'm just warming up. But in all seriousness, that is actually how this podcast started. We, Jeremy and myself, fully realised that we need to tell this story better. And it's not just a case of attending a boring old stormwater conference, talking to a whole bunch of other boring old stormwater engineers. You got to go out there.
Oh, I'm offended. That's how we met, Brad.
But that, to my point, like that Urban Water Symposium, that's actually a fairly rare thing. You know, getting the likes of yourself, Denise, and a whole bunch of other sort of stakeholders in a room together to talk about plastic pollution. You know, traditionally, stormwater engineers had their own conference and we did our own thing. And actually, we never spoke to the likes of CSIRO. We're, you know, battling the problem at once stage.
It's also about our company name 5 years ago was Stormwater 360. Oh, so do you deal in sewer and sewage? No, it's stormwater. Well, is it the same thing? So then you go through that. Oh, no, we stop pollution going out to the ocean. Oh, you do sewer. So that's, along with the podcast, we pivoted the whole company and went, well, hold on, Ocean Protect, because that's what we're doing. We've really put the awareness around it. But have we made the gains that we wanted to? No, we haven't. We've tried to make it as sexy as you can.
You only employ the good-looking people.
Absolutely. Oh, it's like a male moral convention at Ocean Protect half the time, you know.
But my point is, even with a bit of sexiness, even with great data to show people, guys, it's coming from here. We know it is. Here's all the data. Government, for instance, Justine, do you know that? Well, you probably do by now. It's mostly a legal requirement to put these devices in, but it's not a legal requirement to empty the rubbish out of them. Do you know that?
Yeah. I think it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
I don't understand.
It's obviously our fault as an industry. And I harp on about it. We call it maintenance. We're calling it the wrong thing. We're emptying an underground rubbish bin full of hazardous waste. Is it us? And when I say us, our industry.
For many ways, we as an industry, we haven't communicated or told our story as effectively as we should. But at the same time, we're battling a fairly apathetic community, if I'm honest. Plastic pollution wasn't on the public radar up until probably the last 10 or so years. It's obviously got a lot of attention now and people are just getting their head around it. A lot of the imagery is very, you know, visual. You can see it and it looks like it's being discarded from, you know, shipping nets, or you see the commercial fishing nets catching a whole bunch of dolphins and turtles or whatever. You see the microplastics in the ocean, you think someone's just littering from their boats, but people don't understand the stormwater network is the key contributor. Rain falls that washes our streets and roads clean and urban environments, but that pollution goes somewhere. And as we know, Jeremy, we've sat in very prestigious meetings with environmental individuals, environmentalists, without mentioning your names, and with 35 years plus experience of environmental science, etc., and they didn't even know stormwater went to the creeks and rivers. They thought it went to a wastewater treatment plant.
And politicians, state politicians, and their portfolio was the environment, and they thought the sewer and the stormwater were the same thing.
Yeah, so we're battling, in part, previously apathetic community, but also a community that just didn't understand the fundamentals. In this short space of time that we've been charging on this issue, I think we actually have made a big difference. We know, for example, we just had Blacktown City Council's Daniel Ryder on the show talking about their compliance program, incentivising and ultimately enforcing the maintenance of stormwater treatment assets. And that'll go across the country in time. And look, I think the more and more of the public, in many ways, as a direct result of this podcast, have actually increased their understanding of the issue and what we can do about it, which brings me to my positive story note. So what can we do about it? You know, so obviously, Justine, you mentioned before that you've done a bit of research, but your focus, your team's focus is on essentially stopping or helping stop pollution entering our oceans and waterways from land-based sources. So how are you guys doing that?
So within Australia, we're working with federal government to develop technology around monitoring how much plastic or pollution goes out through the stormwater system. So Australia as a whole is pretty good at not littering. We have behavioural changes over the last few decades means that we're pretty good at picking up after ourselves, but we also know research shows that we still have a lot of litter leaving our land sources and going out into the ocean. So the majority of what's polluting the ocean is coming through stormwater systems. So that's our focus. So we are working with people like you to develop a sensor technology to help us understand how much litter is in gross pollutant traps in stormwater systems, so that you will get a little alert to say your stormwater traps are full and you need to go and empty them. Because like you said, Jeremy, there's no rules around monitoring and emptying gross pollutant traps. So that's part of what we're doing, is trying to develop a technology that helps the industry keep on top of their litter traps more effectively.
We're collaborating with CSIRO on this initiative. And look, for my mind, it's a revolution. It's a game changer. So as many would be aware, there's thousands, tens of thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of these gross pollutant traps within Australia in the ground currently. And their job is they're like underground garbage bins, intercepting stormwater and capturing pollution. The key problem is a lot of these assets just aren't getting that pollution that they are designed to catch. They're not getting that pollution removed. And there's a few challenges to that. You know, a lot of people don't actually know when they are due for a service or a pollution removal. To actually inspect a lot of these assets, it's a big process. Sometimes you've got to lift a very large access cover, which often requires heavy machinery or at least some fairly strong individuals. It is time consuming, costs money, et cetera. But what CSIRO in the process of developing in collaboration with Ocean Protect and others, I'm sure, is a sensor technology, which is very cheap, you know, resilient, has a very, very strong battery life, very small, and we can essentially put it in these gross pollutant traps to determine when these assets do need to be, have that pollution removed. For my mind, it's an absolute game changer for our industry.
This Mental Health Month, Bupa's working in partnership with This Way Up to help prepare members for life's ups and downs. Search Bupa Mental Health to find out how. Bupa, because life happens.
For treatment demonstrated to reduce acne blemishes, look no further than SkinCeuticals Silymarin CF, the oil-free vitamin C antioxidant answer for oily and blemish-prone skin. Silymarin CF works to manage oil oxidation as a preventative vitamin C solution, and when combined with Blemish Plus Age Defense, reduces visible blemishes by 36%. Learn more now on skinceuticals.com.au. All orders come with free standard shipping and 3 bonus samples valued up to $90 with every order.
I think it's a game changer too, but let's take that a step further. Okay, the alert goes off, beep, 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 it's full. Go to the private asset owner and say, mate, you've got to do that. No, I don't. Tell me what I have to do. It's not law. I'm not going to do that. Get stuffed. We know when they're full. We know because we do load tests. We know roughly that if it's in there for a year and based on the land use, we roughly know when they're going to fill up. Sure, it does cost us money to do an open inspection. But the problem is, then once you've done it, there's no stick. You know, you can have an alarm as loud as you want, but there's no stick behind that. There's no enforcement. There's no, okay, buddy, it's full. If you don't do that, I mean, apart from Blacktown, one LGA in all of Australia, there's no stick to the developer. If it was a wastewater treatment system and we had a sensor on it, everyone would be like, oh God, there's heaps of shit in there. We're going to go and get it. It's by law, we've got to do it. The problem is with the legislation, guys. That's my opinion. There is no legislation around it.
What do you think to that, Justine?
So part of this big project we're doing with federal government too is to actually speak to people in the industry and find out what the issues are. And so hopefully I'll come up with some pretty solid data in the next couple of months with feedback from people like yourselves around how many people within the industry feel like we need legislation towards this. I fully agree. I think there needs to be a consequence. There's no consequence. And the other thing is that a gross pollutant trap, when it's full, looks the same full now as it will in 6 months' time. So you might arrive to it and go, oh, we caught it just in time, but actually it's been out of use for months. Others I've spoken to have said that they don't think legislation will ever get off the ground or will help in any way. So
who the hell said that?
I won't say any names, but they think it's not as simple as that. It's just legislation. And to some extent, I agree. You know, I think we need improvements in, for one, in recognition of what stormwater, you know, the fact that we pollute through stormwater. And it seems like a lot of people, as you say, within higher levels of management in these areas don't even understand that that's a problem. Improved technology for monitoring, perhaps a little more awareness around the community, understanding that our rates are going towards preventing pollution. And the consequence through legislation.
Look, so if I can just comment on legislation for a sec, will legislation make a difference? No, because it's already illegal to not remove the pollution from these assets. So under most council development conditions, you have to manage your stormwater treatment assets appropriately. And that's the case whether it's Blacktown City Council, Brisbane City Council, Melbourne City Council, it doesn't matter. If you are mandated to put these assets in, generally the council require you to maintain it. Now, currently they don't enforce that, and that's the key issue. And I'm going to go through the other legislation. So in Victoria, there's a clause 56.07.4, which says you have to manage your assets in accordance with the satisfaction of the relevant drainage authority. There's also an environmental duty under the Victorian EPA legislation. Similarly, in Queensland Environmental Protection Act, you have to do it. You've got a general environmental duty, and maintaining stormwater treatment assets and removing that pollution is consistent with that duty. You can't let pollution leak out of any asset that would cause damage to the environment. Same thing in the New South Wales legislation under the Protection of the Environment Operations Act of 97. I'm just going to read it out. The person must not willfully or negligently cause any substance to leak, spill or otherwise escape in a manner that harms or is likely to harm the environment. And a person who pollutes any waters is guilty of an offence. Now, when you don't remove pollution out of stormwater treatment assets, that's exactly what you do. You allow pollution to leak, spill and otherwise escape. That leakage or spilling over does cause environmental harm. So long story short, so the legislation is already in place, exists, that mandates the appropriate removal of pollution from these assets. The key deficiency, to Jeremy's point before, is no one is enforcing that legislation. But look, you know, you've got to obviously have some sort of means of detecting that pollution that is potentially spilling before you can actually bring the stick in. Now, does this sensor technology make sure that all our assets in the ground are going to be appropriately managed and have that pollution removed? No, but it's a very key part of it. Through this sensor technology, we will readily understand when these assets are due for a pollution removal. And then it's up to the next, the relevant authority to make sure that pollution is removed.
And not only that, it's reducing the cost of us doing business. Meaning, you know, so say, for instance, we've got one at Ranwick City Council. Well, we think it's going to be full in maybe 2 months' time, so we'll go out, we'll mobilise 3 people, we'll do a confined space entry, actually, it's not. Well, that's just wasted $5,000, you know, so it's going to make us more efficient. And hey, look, Denise and I, you know, that's how this all came about, is through our sense of technology and our love for it. Don't get me wrong, we certainly need it, but humans are bloody lazy. Unless there's a stick going, if you don't do this, there's going to be a consequence, Justine said it before, then no one's going to change.
I'd like to see eventually, if we had a sensor like this in all GPTs across Australia, if we mandated that there had to be a sensor, and then those alerts going through to the EPA or someone so that they could go, well, this council hasn't emptied anything for a certain amount of time.
I reckon the notification should also go to the local environmental groups that otherwise have to do their beach cleanups every weekend, pulling the pollution off the beaches and waterways that would otherwise have been prevented through appropriate management of these assets.
Make it public. That's what I was about to say.
Absolutely.
The other problem with stormwater is, you know, you've heard me say it 1,000 times, Brad, it's unique. It crosses political boundaries. It crosses physical boundaries. And in our political, when we're talking political boundaries in Australia, we've got the federal government, we've got state government, we've got local government. Now, local government are typically the people that are burdened with these assets, whether that's from enforcing the private developer to put them in or for them putting their own devices in. Now, local government need help, often and very often under-resourced from a personnel point of view, from a monetary point of view. So they physically don't have the money to do it. And then it comes the political pressure. Say, for instance, you know, local government elections are coming up. You know, what do people actually care about? Potholes, buses on time, or playgrounds, because that's what they, you know, or do they care about something that they don't see or, you know, it's underground? Going back to I guess, what we're trying to do, now the data's coming out, and I've got an interesting article, a scary article about a study done here in New Zealand about 70% of the fish in New Zealand have plastic in them. Now, with those tools, people start to go, oh, how did that get there? So we're slowly not drawing, you know, people like CSIRO, you know, all the people out there collecting data. We're starting to paint this picture so people can see it. It's just taking too long. And as you guys all know, we're running out of time quick.
I actually am keen to talk about some of the other work that you've been doing, but I think it is also related, Justine. You mentioned in a little chat we had recently that you're doing some work for DAWE, which I think is the Australian Department of Agriculture, Water and Environment.
They recently changed their name actually to DQ, Department of Climate Change, Energy, the Environment and Water. And woohoo! I feel very proud of myself that I got that one out.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. That's the federal government department that I mentioned before that we're working with. We're doing a really big project with them. So the Australian government have a national plastics plan. And so under that, they're doing all sorts of things to try and minimise plastic pollution in Australia. So we have a really big project with them where we have four activities. One of them's in the stormwater space, but there's one looking at impacts on endangered species in Australia of plastic and entanglement and ingestion. There's a project looking at establishing a bit more data around how much we're polluting in general. So we've done a lot of work in this space around creating, we call it a baseline, you know, what is it that Australia is producing from land in terms of pollution? And the other activity that we're doing is working with the government to create a national online hub or portal that everyone who collects plastic pollution data can send their data to. And so we'll have one-stop shop for looking at data around plastic pollution. And that's the problem at the moment is that a lot of states have their own database. CSIRO, we have our own database as well. And then there are a lot of little NGOs that collect data around pollution and don't send their data anywhere. So we're trying to create a national hub to put all that information into so that we can compare and see what's happening, and we can look at where the hot spots are, also where the cold spots are, and look at, you know, for those areas that don't have a lot of litter pollution, is it because they're remote, or is it because that council has really good infrastructure and policy around pollution?
Huge, huge project. And obviously Ocean Protect are involved in that. Without sort of getting too far ahead of the research, I think I know what the answer will be. It'll be basically where you've got people and impervious areas, you'll have a lot of pollution.
Yeah, it's not just about population. One of the biggest factors is socioeconomic.
Yes, yeah.
Less, more so than population, You know, I completely understand this. For people that can afford to have the headspace around making choices about what they consume and the way they deal with their litter is one thing. But if you haven't got the headspace to even, you know, put food on the table, I can understand why it's not a priority.
We've talked about, you know, intentional littering, and we're talking about human behavioural mechanisms for how litter gets out there. You know, in Australia, we don't treat our motorways to a very high level. You think about it, whether it's the federal government or the state government, they build a new highway, the water runs off there and then goes down to local creeks and eventually ends up in the ocean. Correct me if I'm wrong, Brad, but, you know, the research out there is around 30% of microplastics in our oceans actually comes from tyre wear. I'm not sure if you're aware of that sort of that number. Let's call it a hell of a lot, you know, let's call it 25%.
Yeah,
a hell of a lot. And yet in Australia, we don't treat to that level. So have you looked into that? Is there any research? Because you're looking at what's out in the receiving environment, you must have come across that. Is that something that you're going to tackle, look into? Because, you know, Ocean Protect and other people within our industry, we've known it for a hell of a long time. You know, we physically see it all the time. And I tell you what's not going to stop is cars. Whether they're electric, whether they're petrol, hydrogen, doesn't matter. We're going to still try and put rubber on the ground. What are your thoughts on that, Justin?
I think you raise a really good point. And no, we don't do any work in that area. We have to pick and choose our battles a little bit with what we focus on. And as a group, we're always coming up with new ideas. Oh, we should do this, and we should look into that. And we have to dial it back to say, you know, we're only a small group. we have to try and maximize what we can do within a small group. You're right. It's one of those, I think, when it comes to microplastics that you're referring to from tyres, it's not something visible, and people really find it hard to relate to something that they can't see, which has been a huge problem with climate change discussions. So microplastics fall into the same category, I think, is that we can't see the problem. We don't see the plastic coming off our tyres as we drive. And so we focus on other things. And even at CSIRO, we're focusing at the broader CSIRO, are focusing on bigger things like they're working with an organisation in WA at the moment to produce a single-use plastic type, thin plastic sort of material from seaweed. So, you know, we pick and choose what we focus to work on. The low-hanging fruit is what we can see and hold in our hand, and unfortunately tyres just don't come into that category yet.
For sure. And this is more of a point here, Brad and I and our industry. When the research is pretty solid out there that we know that a hell of a lot is coming from motorways and from tyres, yet we're not doing one iota about it, that concerns me. If it was 1% and, you know, we can't afford to do that research. But when the figure's so high, and let's face it, Brad, we know that. We do have devices that happen to be on some form of road. And when you pop the lids on those, the smell is unbearable. But the black gunk of crap that you can see, and it's all mushed together. That's revolting to even.
Oh, right. You can visibly see it.
You can see your samples of it.
Wow.
But you know, you can analyze the crap out of it. And we physically see it. So it's not out of sight, you know, from our point of view. And yet we, you know, it's such a big number coming from roads and the fact that we don't treat them. I mean, Aussies love our roads. I mean, there's roads everywhere. Let's go, mate. Let's go from buddy, Sydney to Brisbane in 7 hours, mate. You know what I mean? And it just it astonishes me why someone's not tackling it. Is it the roading companies? Is the local government going too hard? You know, I don't know. Brad, thoughts?
Oh, look, you mention it every time. It's about money. So there's a lot of money in building roads. And I think the average road is something like $1,000 or something crazy per meter of road. And, you know, there's bitumen, there's pipes, there's whatever, but no one really thinks to spend any money on actually protecting the pollution or stopping the pollution which comes from these roads. We know it's, you know, the number one source of microplastics is roads. Whether it be wear and tear from tires, and the average tire across its life loses about a kilo. And we know that microplastic isn't an inert natural rubber. It's a highly synthesized chemical cocktail of fish and marine species killing contaminants. Simple as that.
We don't even recycle our tires yet. We're still producing more and more of this.
But we know we can solve this problem easily. So in New Zealand, as we both know, they make sure that their key road areas or their major roads have appropriate stormwater treatment assets. But for some reason in Australia and other parts of the world, we just don't require that. But it's an easy thing. We put devices in, whether they be a gully basket or a GPT or a bioretention system, wetland, we can massively, as long as we just intercept that flow from the road to the waterway through any way we can, we'll stop that microplastic. Easy win, but it comes down to money.
Do you have data on that, on how much your traps pull out?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yes, but in terms of microplastics, I was going to comment. So whilst we haven't got collaboration with CSIRO on this issue, we are collaborating with another group called OSMAP, which is the Australian Microplastic Assessment Project.
Shout out to Michelle.
Yeah. She's a previous podcast guest, as was Scott Wilson from OSMAPs as well. But yeah, we're collaborating with them currently to work out, or at least quantify, how much microplastics is in the devices that we put in our road environments. And look, whether it's a gazillion microplastics or a bazillion, doesn't really matter. It's a lot. I can tell that. And I know this is something we've talked about before, Michelle, is that when we look inside these gross pollutant traps or galley pit baskets, you do see a lot of organics and sediment, and people go, that's not pollution. That's all hunky dory. But we both know that there's a whole bunch of litter and microplastics in those, in that accumulated material as well. I remember you said in passing when we were in Hobart, you said for every 3 or 4 litres of material in a GPT? Every 3 litres of material.
For every 3 litres of organic material in a gross pollutant trap, there's 1 litre of plastic pollution.
That's staggering. And again,
that's the estimation.
Yeah. And that's easy to remove. Easy to pull out and stop from flying downstream.
That's it. I think, you know, if you think about all of the assets that aren't in place around Australia, all the rivulets and rivers and, you know, stormwater runoff that just goes straight out into the ocean with no traps at all. what are we doing to our oceans?
What are we? But look, you've obviously been in this space for a while. You've been plastic. You're sciencing the hell out of this issue.
Yeah.
Are you optimistic about the plight of our oceans and waterways?
That's a really hard question. It depends on the day.
Yeah, what is today?
Environmental depression is a real thing. Yeah. You know, sometimes I get bogged down in it and think, oh, man, it doesn't matter how much work we do, we're not making much of a difference. And then other times, you know, someone will pat me on the shoulder that's just met me when I tell them what I do, and they say, thanks for doing that. You know, I'm really glad that there are people out there doing that. And then you walk away thinking, yeah, we're making a difference. This is all going to work out fine. So, you know, I think the frustrating part is that we know how to make improvements, and Australia is a nation where we've got the intelligence to do this. And I think the majority of the people out there are genuinely, if they had a choice whether to pollute or not, they would say not. I think we complicate everything. We see our society just seems to complicate everything. And especially when it comes to the environment, it's like you say, there are no boundaries around environmental issues. If we could blame a particular location or a particular company, then we'd be hard on it, wouldn't we? But it's a shared issue, and collectively we're not very good at dealing with shared issues.
When COVID first hit, Brett and I were doing a lot of work trying to convince government that obviously stormwater is an issue and so forth. And Brad crunched the numbers, and we came up with this pretty good plan called Zero Litter to Ocean. And it was in a time where we thought, you know, the world was going to literally implode, everyone's going to be out of a job. And, you know, the world is still imploding, and people, people are finding it.
We just got used to the implosion.
Yeah, we've got used to it. But we ran some numbers, and we came up with a pretty good argument to employ thousands of Australians to go out and clean these devices. So we made a positive case for stimulating the economy, employing people, and stopping a shitload of pollution going out to our ocean. You know, so it's almost like we're almost making money here, guys. And geez, we had a lot of support. Well, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 organizations around Australia got on board. But even then, it sort of just dwindled away. So even when we say, hey, guys, this is going to save money, it's going to save the environment, you know, we're ticking all the boxes here. You know, it still doesn't get there. And that is a frustrating thing for me. Like, when it comes back to the numbers, we know, and I'm not a scientist and I pretend to be, but we know hand on heart that if we stop it here, it's going to be far cheaper than stopping it out there. It's going to be far more effective for the environment. We know that, yet it falls on deaf ears. And, you know, we've got, another 9 years to go until the planet, you know, explodes. What are we going to actually do about it? It's why we have people like you on the show.
You make a good point that it's cheaper to stop it now before it gets out into the ocean, but it's cheaper to do nothing.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. And that's the problem.
That is the cheapest option, is to do nothing. You're right.
Yeah. But, you know, what's the cost? What's the actual cost, though, of not doing anything?
Well, this is the thing. The costs of inaction are exorbitant, and they're actually we can't do the sums. Because if we know, you know, Jeremy's point, you know, 70% of fish off the coast of New Zealand are full of plastic. What's it going to be like in 10, 20 years' time if we don't do anything? You know, a third of the world's protein.
And it's set to double by 2040. Yes.
Exactly.
And right? It's just increasing, even though we know what we're doing.
Yeah.
It's wrong.
It's crazy. And like a third of the world's protein comes from marine species. And so what are the implications for food security, human health, et cetera? Mm-hmm. The consequences of inaction are enormous. But having said that, we're in this golden opportunity to actually do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And to the point around, and the quote I like to use around optimism is to just, now more than ever, we need to be stubbornly optimistic. And I always use the story of Siddhartha Gautama, the guy who was previously known as Buddha. 2,500 years ago, he said, a bright mind might be the ultimate goal of meditation, but it's also the first step. Without it, you cannot proceed. You cannot move forward. And obviously we need the brightest of minds to actually solve the plastic pollution crisis impacting our oceans.
Or at least the most optimistic. Hey?
Absolutely. And we do need to be optimistic. Yeah. We do need to be stubbornly
optimistic.
Yeah, we do.
Optimistic. Yeah. Otherwise we'd all just sit in a ball and cry.
Yeah, exactly. And we're obviously not going to do that. We're going to sit back. It's Friday. We're going to hit the weekend and, you know, go out charging but ultimately we do need to take this issue seriously and actually act accordingly. And it's not just a problem that we can handle to government technology or just someone else. It's an everyone, everywhere mission. And we all need to work collectively and effectively to help solve this problem. And from my perspective, I'm personally so proud that, you know, Ocean Protect, Jeremy and myself in particular, have worked so closely in collaboration with CSIRO, recognizing you guys are essentially the primo prestigious science organization in Australia, you know.
Funded by the federal government.
And that,
but, you know, you guys were the big dogs.
Completely.
Well, you are, you know, that's like, I remember when we started off trying to like get in touch with you guys, we were like, no one's going to believe us, but they'll believe them.
Yeah.
And that's how we started. No one does, but if CSIRO comes out and says something, it gets a headline.
It does hold some weight, doesn't it? Yeah, it does.
Sure. So you guys better get back to work.
I think what you guys are doing is so unique as well, though, to have an organisation that sits within industry and, you know, your role is to provide a service in the community to make a profit and to be able to continue as an organisation. But to do that with environmental values is really unique. And so that's why we're really thrilled to be working with you, because you have such a unique view in business. And I wish that there were more like you across all areas of business. But, you know, even the slogan on the back of your truck I saw when I went to Sydney last week to meet Ocean Protect, I took a photo. I can't remember what it was. Do you know what it is? The slogan on the back of your truck?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If we kill the oceans, we kill ourselves.
No,
stopping pollution entering waterways?
No, it's to do with grandchildren. Yeah. We don't inherit the earth from
our parents. We borrow it from our grandchildren.
It's my line. I should know.
Great.
We don't inherit it from our parents. We're borrowing it from our grandchildren. Yeah, I love it. So you saw it. It's only a small one.
The fact that you have that on your trucks, you know, it shows the reason why you're in this game. And it's very unique.
I always say I've got the weirdest job in the world in that we are a for-profit company, but we are so active, as Jeremy and myself in particular.
And all Ocean Protect.
Absolutely.
Anyone's, you know, we're just the kooks that jump on the podcast. You know, we've got 50-plus staff running around doing their various jobs, and all of them are very, very passionate about what we do. And that is what makes us unique. We're a for-profit.
I wish it wasn't so. I wish it wasn't unique.
Yeah, I've got to tell you, that's how this started as well, like in terms of whether it be podcasting or go around giving talks and advocating for zero litter to ocean, which Jeremy referred to the policy paper before. If you want to learn more about it, just go to zerolittertoocean.com.au. You talk about creating jobs. We create about 7,500 jobs, stop about 600 wheelie bins of plastic going into our oceans every day. I think it's a pretty simple thing to do. In the absence of anyone else talking about this issue around the importance of stormwater and how it impacts on our oceans and waterways, we've just done it ourselves. And hopefully in time, there'll be 1,000 other groups just like us doing the same.
Oh, wouldn't that be good? I would love to not have a job anymore because
I was about to say that. We would love to be out of business, because if we were out of business, that means there wouldn't be a problem anymore.
Speaking of jobs, you do have a job to do, Justine, and we better let you get back to it. But from the bottom of my heart, thank you. Buddy Bieber, sorry.
Get to work.
But look,
come on, see us around.
But look, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on our little podcast today. It's so good to talk to you. And also, thank you so much and your team for the amazing work that you guys do. Just keep it up.
Right back at you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for all the good work you do.
Boom, boom.
Shake the room.
Thanks for listening to the Ocean Protect podcast. If you'd like to find out more about us and what we do, check us out at oceanprotect.com.au.